Today is my brother's 27th birthday. It's only 7 in the morning, one of those hot, brown, swampy days in Washington. The air so thick it's difficult to breathe. Children drape like damp claws over the fire hydrants, around the lampposts, too weary to play. The long-suffering National Guardsmen, half asleep in their fatigues and sidearms, lean against the cool marble of government buildings. I've arrived early at the Eastern Market, since my mother will be coming for a special lunch this afternoon, the first time she has been to my apartment since I moved away from home. She'll bring her sister, my Aunt Faith, and perhaps her son, my cousin, who lost his leg 4 years ago in an explosion. His leg, but not his life, my mother says, every time his name, which is Bernard, comes up. My mother would prefer to recognize the day of my brother's murder. It's in her character, just as it's in my father's, to celebrate the day of Stephen's birth, to slip over the evening of April 4th when my only brother was shot on the steps of the George Washington University Gelman Library, where he was studying for his law exams. My father likes to think the years will continue to accumulate to Stephen, although our memory of him is locked in at 25. I understand the feelings of both of my parents and neither of them. It's the way with parents. Just as you think you know them, they slide away like mercury, breaking into slippery bits that would take endless patience to reassemble. I am no longer a patient woman. The market is southeast of the Capitol near Union Station and is open every morning from 6 a.m. until 2, although recently the vendors have been closing down quickly at noon, loading their trunks and trucks and beating it out of town during the lunch hour when trouble, if it's going to happen, usually begins. This morning, I wander through the stalls, pleased to be in the company of people, pressing against women who lean over the wooden tables with their fruits and vegetables to weigh. We smile back and forth, familiar to one another since most of us shop every day, buying little, only sufficient to last through breakfast the next morning, a sense of transience about our lives. For months before Stephen was killed, there had been a silent civil war, fear creeping under the skin, a menacing suspicion of one group of people for another, a distrust of the outsider in a city of outsiders. Now we've been in a state of emergency for almost 3 weeks. The National Guard circling the city of Washington, something that has happened only once in recent memory, during the riots that broke out after the death of Martin Luther King Jr. Now there seems to be an actual civil war, difficult to describe. Who to trust, my mother asked at a recent Sunday dinner, turning the front page of the newspaper face down. It's as if everyone is the enemy, or could be. This country isn't a safe house, Julia, my father said. Then I want to move, she said, getting up from the table, clearing the plates, turning on the water to rinse them. Where would we go, I asked. Away, she said with conviction, as if she knew a route. Try these. A withered, prune-faced woman burned dark by the sun gives me a taste of artichokes mixed with chickpeas and spices. It's delicious. I love these small Jerusalem artichokes and think I'll make a salad of them for lunch with sweet tomatoes and maybe mango, which is ripe and not too soft, even in this heat. The goat cheese is light, and I get a small piece of it rolled in herbs and crusty olive bread and roasted red peppers, which the vendor says she makes herself. I think a lot about food, especially sweets and fruit, the rosy fruits in particular, peaches and plums and cherries. Every morning since Asa was 3 weeks old, and he's almost 3 months now, I walk from my apartment along East Capitol past Lincoln Park to the market. And walking, I babble to Asa and think about food. I buy, of course, but very little. I don't eat that much myself, skinny with nerves, and Asa is still nursing. But I imagine putting meals together, elaborate meals, to which I'd invite strangers who would become friends, women with children and single men and fathers and soldiers, some of the people I see day after day at the market. We speak, but I don't know their names. I'm having a lunch party, I say to the woman vendor who gave me the artichoke dip to taste. Very nice. She pops a raspberry into my mouth. Good? Excellent, I say. Who's coming to your luncheon? She asks. My mother. Do you know her? Your mother? She's small with curly hair which hasn't gone gray yet. I'm proud of that about my mother. Her hair, still dark at almost 60, gives me a sense of permanence. I know your mother, of course, the woman says. She comes with you on weekends, all the way in town from the suburbs. Her name is Mrs. Frayn, I say, to place her as a friend. People in Washington know about our family because of Stephen. Not that it's unusual for a young man to die here. Many have been killed in the 20 years since we moved from New York City when Stephen was 7 and I was almost 3. But then the violence was personal. Drugs or guns or gang warfare or domestic quarrels. And in the last few months, it's a random bomb or arson or a staged accident. And several are injured or die at once. Stephen was assassinated in the late afternoon and he was alone. Except I was standing beside him. It wasn't an accident that he was the one chosen. It'll be my mother's first visit to my apartment, I say to the woman vendor, for no particular reason, except I feel I owe her something personal about myself, since she gave me a raspberry. I'm careful about these things, avoiding obligations, wishing to keep a balance with people, even in matters as small as this. Your father's coming to lunch, too? I shake my head, a reserve settling over me. It isn't her business about my father's plans, but I answer anyway, which I know isn't necessary. But I have that need to respond to any question. Learn to say shut up, my mother says to me. Two words, very simple, but I never do. My father's working, I say, although it isn't exactly true. My father's a professor of medicine at George Washington University, where Stephen and I went to school and graduate school. He's on summer holiday from classes, but today he's probably in his hangar, rebuilding an airplane that has taken up most of our backyard since I can remember, and much of my father's time, especially since Stephen's death. It's an old World War II fighter plane that he bought at an auction, and he's in the long process of restoring it to its original shape. But he wouldn't come to lunch at my apartment in any case. You must understand that I can't come visit you in your apartment, Claire, my father said to me when I was packing up to move. You should be living in my home. I did understand. Perhaps he was more upset than he knew that I was having a baby out of wedlock because we're an old-fashioned family, although not religious, holding to the daily rituals of an orderly life, and for good reason. But I know it isn't the baby. He's glad to have this baby, although he's never asked who the father is and would be distraught to know, and doesn't in general believe it's a good thing to bring a baby into a troubled time. But it is life, and he knows that, or he wouldn't be rebuilding an airplane, hoping that once it's completed, he'll be able to fly it. Of course, he doesn't consider how he'll fly, or where he'll be permitted to take off and land, or what rules of the air would apply to a novice with a rebuilt warplane. And that's the point. One doesn't think of these things, or babies would never be born in wartime. My moving was a failure to him. I think he was embarrassed that his family couldn't hold together under one roof after Stephen died. He thought it was a reflection of his weakness. But he's not a weak man, and he misses me, and he wishes I were there every morning at breakfast, both for his pride and my company. Milo can be sullen. And my mother is argumentative, and I am sunlight to him, though God knows not so bright as the days we've been having this summer. My father isn't the one who asked me to call the baby Stephen. My mother did. But typically, she said it was at my father's request, and he didn't want to impose. Nevertheless, it would mean a great deal to him, and after all, what immortality is there for the dead unless the living hold on to their names? I suppose I believe that, too. If I believe in any immortality, it would have to be the passing on of names of the dead to the babies, as the Jews do. I thought about Stephen as a name and couldn't live with it. I'm superstitious by nature, and to give a baby my brother's name seemed as if I were asking bad luck for Asa. Besides, and this perhaps is more important, I loved Stephen. I should clarify the irony of our situation. We aren't Jewish or Muslim and Christian only to the degree that until the 9/11 attack on the United States, when we began living with this whispering civil unrest, we were half-hearted Quakers, believing in what my father calls peaceful coexistence. My mother, born Jewish, has never been a natural believer of any kind, but my father is still a member of the Society of Friends. In principle, he says, but in practice, it's foolish to stand in a war zone and turn the other cheek. I am a biologist. When my mother used to introduce me to people in the glass-blowing factory where she's a designer, she'd say with real emotion in her voice, "My daughter, Claire, is a student of living things." Since Stephen's death, her voice assumes a flat and hollow tone. "My daughter, Claire, is a student of living things." Ha. And the ha has the rattle of a final breath. "A true believer," Stephen used to say of me when we went to university together. It amused him, my love for what he called the creepy crawlies and fuzzy wuzzies and slippy slimies that decorated my bedroom. But true belief is fairy dust, and I'm a scientist. It's after 8, and I've finished marketing. Asa is fussing because he's ready to nurse, and I'm looking for my friend Eva, who's been my dearest friend since 4th grade. It's Wednesday, and we've arranged to meet, as usual, at the market before she goes to work. If there weren't this civil upheaval, Eva would be a dancer, but as it is, she's a technician at the hospital where Stephen was taken when he was shot. So she was the one who called my parents to say there'd been a catastrophe. We used to do everything together, but after my brother was killed, her parents wouldn't permit her to go to public places with me, not even a film or a restaurant. Certainly not the busy market. I'm a marked woman. It's difficult to be my friend. Nevertheless, every day or two, we try to meet at the market to catch up. She doesn't tell her parents, of course, and isn't as concerned about being in my company as they are for her. "But I have to tell you, Claire, I do worry," she has said on occasion. I look around, staying longer than I had planned, but Eva doesn't seem to be here, and just her absence this particular day, perhaps because it's Stephen's birthday, is a bad omen to me. "No meat for your lunch?" the vendor asks, holding up a chicken roasted on a spit and smothered in herbs. I shake my head. "Vegetarian?" she asks. "It's too hot for meat," I say. The vendor has come around the corner of her kiosk and is leaning over Asa, reaching under the umbrella I've attached to his stroller to protect him. "Fat," she says, looking at him and shaking her head. "He's eating you up." Something about her interest alarms me, so I say thank you, and that will be all for today, and I dip the umbrella so Asa is no longer visible to the assembled shoppers. As I lift my head from covering Asa, brush my hair off my forehead, my eyes readjusting to the brightness, I see someone familiar at the next kiosk, and my heart drops. He's standing with his back to me, a rolled bandana around his head, his hair longer than the last time I saw him, curling over the collar of his work shirt. He's purchasing artichokes and black olives and olive oil. Surprising for someone who's come here for a different purpose than marketing. I know this man, although I haven't seen him since last August, and I know why he's here this morning, pretending to shop, actually buying things he doesn't need, reaching across another shopper for figs. He's come here to watch me. Victor Duarte, the name he gave me when I met him a month after Stephen's death, is short and stocky, swarthy with tiny black bean eyes. I used to think he was handsome with an earthy sexuality, a rough tenderness about him, but what did I know then? He's watching me now. I feel his eyes as I hurry away from the market, not running, but moving with dispatch, so I'll seem purposeful but not afraid. I don't turn around for some time, maybe two city blocks, and when I do, no one is behind me that I can see, except an old woman with her marketing in a cloth satchel, struggling up the hill, and an unpleasant-looking short-haired brown dog, who, according to the laws of this city, should be on a leash. My apartment is about a mile from the market on a steady upward incline, so I'm breathless pushing the stroller when I arrive. From my living room on the seventh floor, I can see the city. It looks like the black and white polka dot dress Grandma Frain used to wear to sing in the Welsh church choir, white splashed irregularly on a black background. When I stand in the large window facing north, what I see is an occasional streak of white spreading across the landscape where a random bomb has exploded, taking down a small building like the National Bank and Trust on Wisconsin Avenue in the upper northwest, a gas station in the southeast along the Potomac, a grammar school in Capitol Hill. Sufficient damage to leave a blank that from a distance in this sunny city is white. This has happened since Stephen died a year ago. I moved to Capitol Hill when I was 6 months pregnant because of Asa's father, who had lived here growing up. Asa's grandfather still lives in the same row house on 2nd Street Northeast, behind the Supreme Court, two blocks from the Capitol. I don't know him, but I know about him, and sometimes I walk by his house, which is yellow with lacy vines running up the front. And I imagine him opening the front door just as I walk by, and I say, "Hello, I'm Claire Frain, and this baby is your grandson, Asa." But I've never seen him on my walks, which are in the daytime, so I probably never will. I live on 11th Street just after A, on the top floor of a small pre-war apartment house. My mother thinks it's dangerous with threats of terrorism to live so close to the Capitol. But I like that the streets are full of people walking and shopping and eating, mothers like me with strollers, young men in ties who work for the government, children walking their dogs. Not that it feels safer than the suburbs where I grew up, just busier and less lonely. I don't remember fear, not as a physiological condition like the flu, until the night that Stephen died. Now I have a kind of low-grade fever of anxiety all the time. I start at loud noises or high-pitched ones, at a screeching of brakes or a door slamming. I sleep well, well enough, my bed as far away from the window as possible, Asa in a basket in the corner beside me so nothing can fall on him. This civil war is what earthquakes must have seemed like centuries ago, before anything was understood about fault lines or tectonic plates. There'll be a blast like a firecracker, maybe a pipe bomb in the distance, a crash, and then a rumble, the hissing wind of an inferno. But the occasions are haphazard, almost careless in their planning. Days go by with nothing, and then a day of trouble will follow. By the time I reach the front door of my apartment, I'm panting from the heat and the running and probably from fright. Certainly fear is what I'm feeling as I pick up Asa, drop my groceries in the stroller, and push the 7 button on the elevator. I've come to a decision. It's been on my mind for days, but after I saw Victor Duarte and tore off up the hill, Asa crying with hunger, a decision came without my even thinking about it. When the elevator door opens on the 7th floor, I rush down the hall, open the door to my apartment, and sink into the sofa, lifting my shirt for Asa. It's as if all along in these last months, I've been in the process of discovering that I have a choice. My father answers the phone at the first ring. "I thought you'd be in the hangar," I say. "Too hot," he replies. "Are you coming for lunch?" I ask. "You know the answer to that already, Claire," he says. "But I'd like you to come," I say quietly. I wait for his inevitable hesitation, knowing he can't say no to me and won't say yes. And when he starts to speak, I can almost hear him arranging his sentence in such a way that he can accomplish neither denying me nor coming to lunch. "Why?" he asks, to my surprise. Because I want you to be here, I say. There's something I need to tell you. I hang up the phone and lean against the stove, imagining the conversation I'll have with my parents at lunch. For a year this month, my life has been at risk, and I've told no one, not Eva and not my family. This morning, when I saw Victor Duarte looking for me at the market, I knew that the story I've kept a secret for a year is endangering all of us. When my family comes today, I will tell them the truth. I'll begin on the morning of April 4th, 16 months ago, the day that Stephen died. Thank you.